welcome to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Season 2. That's right, we're finally back. We're finally launching Season 2 of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am so happy to be back with you in the middle of a pandemic, no less. I hope that you are staying safe, that you are staying sane, you are staying healthy, and most importantly, staying home. I'm thinking of all of you. It has been a minute. I had to take a bit of a breather from the podcast. I had a bunch of business I had to take care of. I had to make some money. I had to do some creative projects, get those projects off the ground. So I'm happy to be back here with all of you. This interview today that we're kicking things off is with Scott Cimbala of Massive Music. We actually chatted last year, and he was so gracious and so kind to allow me to delay this and to use our interview as the kickoff to Season 2. He is the managing partner and executive producer of Massive Music, a global music agency creating music for the world's top ad agencies, brands, media, and tech, and many more. So he is going to walk us through his music career trajectory, talk about the industry, and it's just a very interesting, timely stuff. Again, evergreen content, but also very timely just to consider, you know, where do we head next, especially with this pandemic. It's obviously a game changer, but I think you'll get some really good insights from this interview. So let's just kick things off. Here we go, babies. Scott, welcome to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Thank you. Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, so let's go back to the beginning where it all began. Tell us about your first music memory.
I think one of my first music memories was my parents' record collection, frankly. I had exceptionally young parents. They had me when they were 21 and 20 years old. My father was 21. My mother was 20. So they had pretty contemporary music taste at the time. And this was the late 60s, early 70s. So their music collection is one of my first memories. So I would look at the album covers of everybody from Sly and the Family Stone to Chicago to the Grassroots to to James Brown, et cetera, et cetera. So I think I was transfixed immediately by the artwork of the album covers of LPs. And even as a kid, like early on, I was digging into the liner notes and looking at, the photographs associated with the artwork for albums. So yeah, that's one of my first main memories.
I love that you said that because you just gave me like a super visceral memory as well. Like, I think I've kind of forget like how intense the cover art was, especially as a kid viewing that and listening to the music. I mean, my parents had all the Beatles albums and I didn't understand. I mean, I was born early 70s and I didn't understand that these albums were like 10 years old, And it just, you can imagine like Sgt. Pepper's album cover and the Magical Mystery Tour. I was like, they looked almost like children's books to me.
Of course. I mean, I'm not claiming my parents had the best taste in music, except maybe for Sly and the Family Stone. But, it was just what I had readily available. Another key music memory for me was my first album. I mean, the first album I owned, was when I was 4 years old. And I think it was the Jackson 5 Greatest Hits.
So great.
Of course, now with all the Michael Jackson negativity and bad news of even the recent documentary, it's sort of maybe not the musical reference you want to just pull to immediately at this point. But nonetheless, like that was a big record for me at a really young age.
Yeah. And I don't think we should take away from that because I actually have like a Michael Jackson poster up still on my wall.
Cool. Okay.
And I think it starts to become that thing of, can we separate the art from the artist? And in some cases I can, and in some cases I can't. So I think that that's certainly a discussion, but I think it should be sort of an open-ended.
Yeah, I agree. It's a tough one, particularly in today's, day and age. It's like, and so many of our heroes sort of having fallen, you know, whether it's musicians and or actors or, just people in leadership positions, for lack of a better term, whether it's in the creative arts or in other areas of business or whatnot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely. So getting back to your story, did you take any lessons? Did you pick up any instruments when you were growing up?
Well, I think I was forced to play the recorder like most people. And that was happening somewhere during elementary school, back in the dark ages of my education. So I'm going to guess and say that was around the third grade when we were almost required to play the recorder as a class. So I did that for a bit. And then in junior high, I picked up the acoustic guitar and took lessons through my junior high school at the time. And, I actually like the guitar. I love the acoustic guitar. In terms of my ability to have the discipline to really stick with it and practice, I'm afraid I came up a little bit short on that. Not because I wasn't engaged in the instrument itself. I think I just was a lazy kid who, you know, got distracted easy and wanted to do other things. So,
yeah, I wouldn't hold that against you.
maybe I'm a little harsh on myself, but I wish I had stuck with it longer. I think that's what I'm sort of bringing up.
Yeah, that's a good point. But at the same time, I think even just from a purely developmental point of view, you know, sort of like the brain development, it was probably a great brain exercise for you, if nothing else.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So in high school, what were you kind of thinking, looking towards the future and being a grown up? Like, what did you kind of see yourself doing?
Well, it's funny because I was just one of those strange, weird little kids who kind of knew what they wanted to do from the time I was, you know, 7 or 8 years old. I mean, I was literally pressing my head against the radio, you know, listening to music and listening to the radio and listening to different DJs and all that had a huge impact on me. And I just knew from a really early age, maybe it was 8 or 9 or 10, that I wanted to be surrounded and enveloped by music, you know, for my career in my life. And so it was way prior to high school. You know, I just became entranced by the idea of being surrounded by the music that I love.
I want you to go a little bit further into that. Was it radio? Like, was it radio that you felt that real connection, or was it just listening to your own record tape collection, or was it all of the above? Like, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, I just love the magic of radio. There was something about the magic of, you know, the DJ, you know, playing the songs and picking the songs and, you know, being able to call the radio station and request a song. You know, some DJs who had more elaborate, you know, programs that they were running and producing. I was really drawn to that piece. And I was also drawn to just songs, like right from the start. Like, I mean, and so I'm going back to like the mid 70s and, you know, my radio listening, you know, at a really young age, like 10 years old, would waver between AM radio and FM radio. And like back in those days, people like literally listened to AM radio to hear music as well as, you know, what it's become nowadays. But, you know, like I would be listening to stuff like, you know, Elton John or The Carpenters or, you know, again, Sly and the Family Stone. There was just so much great music in that time period between, you know, say 1970 and 1976, you know, happening in the pop world and the rock world, in the R&B world, that I couldn't help but just be, you know, drawn to it. I remember like a neighbor down the street had a poster of Isaac Hayes in their sort of basement rec room. And I just would like, I'd look at that photo, you know, it's like Isaac Hayes with the dark wraparound shades, you know, bald head, kind of muscled out. And, you know, he's got leather and chains. It was sort of during that Shaft period of time. And like just the characters in music at the time, they were so larger than life.
Absolutely. And I think that in the 70s, like everybody sort of looks at the 80s, myself included, but things really started in the 70s in terms of like rap rap started in the 70s, even music videos started in the 70s, like all these things that eventually sort of like blew up all caught fire first in the mid to late 70s. And it was, again, because of what was happening from 71 to 75. So it's just funny because I feel like the 70s sometimes just gets a little bit like dismissed. And it's like, no, you don't understand. Like that was the genesis of so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was just, it was very theatrical. Mm-hmm. You know, the music took on a very thematic and theatrical motif, from different artists, whether it be, you know, from David Bowie and Ziggy Stardust to stuff like Meatloaf to, you know, then later on in hip hop or the beginnings of hip hop, like the Sugar Hill Gang and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. I mean, you know, these were really dramatic, character-based sort of, you know, artists, collectives. All that started in the mid to late 70s.
Yeah. Where did you grow up?
So mostly just the Northeast. I grew up in my whole family was originally from New York.
Oh, wow.
Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island. And then I grew up a little bit there, Boston, and then a little bit of Connecticut as well. So it's kind of like a all Northeastern sort of upbringing. And then moved to Los Angeles upon graduating from college in 1991. And just stayed in Los Angeles ever since.
New York in the 70s, like, holy shit. You were like, you grew up in New York in the 70s. That's pretty amazing. Like, thinking of what went on, there was like so much crime and art going on in the 70s.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, I lived the vast majority of the time during that period in Connecticut. But I just remember, my main experience of spending time in New York City in the 70s was going to Yankee games, you know, in the South Bronx. And literally in the 70s in the South Bronx, like Yankee Stadium was one of the few buildings that wasn't like on fire. I mean, literally, it was rugged in the South Bronx.
Yeah. Those great memories. Amazing. So did you go to college? Where'd you go to college? Like, what did that all look like after high school?
I went to a couple of different schools in high school. You know, most of my life I was in public school or was educated by the public school system. My last 2 years, I went to a private school. And then from there, I went to what was, you know, in my mind, my dream school, which was Emerson College in Boston. And the reason it was my dream school was, well, it was an urban campus. You know, it was a very small school. It specialized in communication and the communication arts. Mm-hmm. And then most importantly, it had probably at the time one of the best radio stations in Boston, which was WERS. So I loved the station. My main goal of going to the college was, you know, to work at the station and become that DJ I pined to be from long ago.
I want to hear more about that because I was just reminded of another one of my guests on here. Adam Lewis was really interested in Emerson for the same reasons, but he ended up going to a different college. And one of his issues with Emerson, and I'm interested if you had this as well, was that he felt like they kind of kept the younger students away from the equipment. It was sort of like almost like a hierarchy, like the juniors and seniors could get all the like awesome shifts or work with all the equipment, and the younger ones were kind of like kept at arm's length from it. Did you have that experience at all or no?
I didn't have that experience, but certainly I had to, with my first DJ gig at WERS, I had to take what was available if I wanted to be on air, like meaning I had to take on a jazz fusion show.
Got it.
Which I knew nothing about jazz fusion.
Right.
And it wasn't like a primary interest for me creatively, but I sort of was like, okay, I'm going to take this because I really want to be on air and I want to be a part of this organization. So quickly I learned about, you know, Miles Davis, Bitches Brew and
nice.
the yellow jackets and Weather Report. And I just was like, okay, I'm going to play this. That's what I'm going to do. Cause I really want to be on air.
Yeah, that's great. And I should say too, I actually grew up in Boston and my family, cause again, it was like 70s, 80s, like we had radio station. So we would always be playing like ERS or WBUR or, you know, WGBH or the Harvard's radio station. And
I still listen to WZBC.
Oh, wow.
Through
that's
Sonos,
funny.
Through TuneIn.
That's great. And again, it was like for us growing up, it was just part of the what's on the radio dial. Like you didn't think like, oh, this was a college station. I think the only time it was jarring is, as you know, how the shows, each show would be so different. So you'd be, you know, like my mom and dad would have like beautiful classical music. And then all of a sudden the next DJ would take over and it would be like screaming thrash.
Right.
And they'd be like, what the hell happened?
Well, no, totally. I mean, but you know, the thing about college radio that I loved, and it was so important to me because I heard so much amazing music for the first time on college radio. Like I remember the first time I ever heard like Sucker MCs by Run DMC was on Wesleyan College's station, WESU. And like that song like blew me away because, you know, coming from the phase of hip hop, which was like, you know, the Force MDs and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, to then what Run DMC did with that just stripped down, you know, hardcore rendition of that song, Sucker MCs. Like to hear that, you know, the only place you could hear that kind of stuff was on, you know, was on college radio. The same with the first time I ever heard Fuck the Police by NWA. That was on WZBC, you know, a Catholic school's radio station. And that song just blew my mind. Like nobody ever did that kind of music or played that kind of music publicly. It was like, you know, that was the underground bubbling up. And so college radio was just so seminal. Like it was just such an important part of my my musical vernacular, let's just say. You
know? And I would say the culture's vernacular as well at the time. And you're absolutely right. I think in Boston, it was like, you're not going to hear rap music probably on any other like corporate FM radio station. I know there was the AM R&B station, WILD, that literally was only on between sunrise and sunset.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, that was it in terms of like R&B or any type of urban music. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously there was like Kiss 108 and stuff like that, but they were more of the sort of like soft, more acceptable, more mainstream. Whereas, yeah, college radio was the ones that were actually breaking these incredible new artists at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll put it to you this way. One of my first jobs when I moved to LA in 1991 was I worked for a public, like an independent public relations firm. And this was a really, it's kind of a funny gig. I actually found it as a temp. Like, so I joined an entertainment temp agency and my first assignment was with this woman who was a small white woman from the Midwest who did independent publicity for hardcore gangster rap. And so like, so I became sort of her assistant and then she started to allow me to, you know, do a lot more with the actual public relations process, as well as getting in contact with radio stations. And some of her clients were like the Ghetto Boys when they put out Mind Playing Tricks on Me and Compton's Most Wanted. And this was all stuff that really wasn't being played on not only FM radio, but it wasn't even being played on, you know, black, you know, traditional, you know, quote unquote black stations. Like, what do we have here? Like KJLH, like none of that was being played at the time. It wasn't until Dr. Dre put out The Chronic that black radio was even interested itself in playing hip hop music and at least gangster rap, you know, like or hardcore rap.
So tell me more about your kind of your college experience. You started with Jazz Fusion and then were you able to eventually kind of have your own, you know, type of show that you could play what you really wanted to play?
Yeah, well, then from there, after gutting it out in the Jazz Fusion minefield for a while, you know, or salt mines, I went and actually I started to do a traditional jazz show, which I loved. Like I love traditional jazz. So, you know, and that was all your typical stuff. Everybody from Thelonious Monk to Coltrane, you know, all the classics, Kind of Blue, Miles Davis. And I loved the traditional jazz show. And I think I did that for a year. So I think I was on the air for about a year and a half, you know, during my, tenure at Emerson, attempting to get my bachelor's degree. So
what did you feel like overall, your experience with Emerson?
I mean, that's a good question. I think part of me felt like I had to go to college, you know, like quote unquote had to go to college, because that was the thing you were told you were supposed to do for a lifetime. And you would have no chance at becoming anything in life without that experience being a prerequisite to having other experiences. So in some cases I felt like sort of a little bit bullied into going the college route. I can't say I was one of those students my whole life where if I was very interested in something, you know, I would excel and do really well. But if I didn't find the content interesting, other subjects, like I literally would just, I could barely show up. So, you know, as a result, my transcript was a little bit inconsistent, you could say. So I was kind of born for the creative business because I wasn't one of those students who could just rally and like try to get the good grade despite not being interested in the subject. So I'd say overall my Emerson College experience was highlighted by my involvement in WERS and most of my academic courses I really didn't care much for. I was on the periphery really of total involvement and immersion in the academic experience. Like I never lived on campus. I always had my own apartment. You know, I didn't join a fraternity or, you know, like it just, I didn't have a normal or what most people view as a normal college experience. So I always felt a little bit on the outside looking in.
Do you feel like at least, and I'm thinking too, probably the time frame, it was just like, well, this is what you do.
Yeah, it was the 80s. I mean, I graduated high school in 85. I mean, we were in the midst of like, you know, it's like the Reagan Bush era, you know, it's like the big, you know, it was like yuppies and, you know, just that sort of the beginning of the right wing ascension in the US, which now looks tame compared to what's going on today. But yeah, it was a strange time. You know, you had these big, as I guess every decade has its multi, it's big cultural sort of events happening around us. And yeah, it was just an odd time, I think, in the United States.
Well, and again, too, I think with in terms of career trajectory back then, it was just kind of like, well, this is the most clear cut path. You know what I mean? I just feel like to some degree, at least, that was sort of like, this is what you do. Nowadays, it's like, oh, you know, there's so many different aspects that and so many different ways you can do it. But I just feel like back then it was a little bit more like narrow. Do you know what I mean?
I agree. And I think one of the things that happened for me in my last year of Emerson was I had formed a friendship with an artist manager in Boston. He managed alternative rock, you know, indie artists. And so I started while I was still in college, or for about the last year and a half I was in college, I started interning with him in his office. And, you know, I mean, Boston always had a lot of great bands, but it didn't have a lot of, you know, traditional music businesses going on. So I started, interning for him, and I learned so much. Like he was managing like Buffalo Tom and Bullet La Volta and this band Come, and another band from the Netherlands that got big for a moment called Betty Severe. So, you know, like he was very much involved in the Boston music scene. And I just learned so much from that experience interning with him while still going to school. And again, that just sort of helped act as a stepping stone to, you know, forming a more professional career or starting a more professional career in the music business.
So let's go through that. So once you graduated, did you just continue working for him or did you go somewhere else or what happened?
Yeah. So that's the minute I graduated. I had it in my head that, I wanted to work in music professionally, wanted to work in the music business in some capacity, whether it be working for a label or something of that nature. And so I knew I had to leave Boston. So I stopped working for him, graduated from school And upon graduation, immediately moved to Los Angeles. And I felt like at the time there were only really two viable choices.
Yeah.
You know, one was to go to New York, which for me would have been the easier, softer way. And I just, you know, having had, you know, having a family from New York, having spent a fair amount of time in New York myself, that didn't interest me as much. So I was much more interested in the exploration of the rest of this country, the west of this country, and Los Angeles in particular, where I knew the entertainment industry and the music industry was a much more viable route to pursue.
And I mean, the joke that, you know, the old joke with Emerson is that they literally hand you a plane ticket upon graduation. Like, there's so many Emerson graduates that go to LA. And I don't know if that was the case when you were there, but
it was. Yeah.
Was it? Yeah. So was that helpful? Did you find that now you had sort of a network that you could tap into when you got to LA?
Not really. Huh. No, no. I mean, and it was probably on me. Like, I just wasn't, again, like I said, I always felt like a little bit of an outsider, like on the outside looking in at Emerson. So when I got to LA, it wasn't like I like flipped open the alumni newsletter and directory, which is what you would have had then, because nothing was online, because online didn't exist yet. And so I didn't really utilize those kind of resources like the alumni directory to get a gig or to try to find that first gig or to network for that matter. So I just really started doing it myself.
Well, what did you do? How'd you do that?
Well, you know, like I had a few friends that were working in the business in Los Angeles. So I knew a couple of people, like one of my friends was working for Geffen Records as like, you know, an assistant to a radio promotion person. And then another friend of mine was working for another small independent record label. And then I had some friends who were working in TV or they were actors or actresses. So I sort of immersed myself in the entertainment industry at large. And one of the first things people told me to do was, yeah, sign up for one of those kind of those entertainment, those temp firms that specialize in the entertainment industry, because it's a good way to potentially get placed for a job that may open up to be a full-time gig down the line. And so that's what I did.
So is that when you start working for that woman,
mm-hmm.
PR woman? Okay. So I'm just trying to think, were you still thinking like radio DJ, or now you were thinking more branching out into like artist management, or where was your head kind of at?
Yeah, that it started to go away from the radio thing severely. And it became more about the record label world, artist management, and pursuing that direction of that route in the music industry. So, you know, after about 9 months of working for that publicist, that independent publicist, I ended up landing a job at a small record label that was a subsidiary of what was then BMG. And they were kind of an eclectic record label. It was actually started by one of the founding members of Tangerine Dream, and it was called Private Music, and they had a very eclectic roster of artists. And so I started working there in a public relations capacity and doing a little bit of international work as well. So, interfacing with some of the territories overseas, helping to set records up and work on records overseas as well. So
it sounds like things started happening pretty fast for you.
They did. Yeah, they did. And it was surprising too, because the economy was not great, at the time, like in 91, 92, it really wasn't happening. But yeah, I landed that job and I stayed there for a year. And then because their roster of artists were just, it just wasn't really my cup of tea. I mean, they were really creative, interesting, very talented artists that they had on the label, but it wasn't like something I would want to play on my own turntable or in my own CD player. So I became a little bit disenfranchised or dissatisfied with the gig and decided to actually launch out on my own. And so with a few people, I did just that. I left that and started my own independent record label, as well as like an independent management firm for artists. And so I did the management firm with a partner who was based in New York and I was in LA. So we had a very small boutique management company for artists.
So what gave you the cojones or the audacity to think you could do that?
I think because there were so many viable and cool little indie labels happening. Like, I mean, you know, like, and some of them are still around today. Like, you know, I would look at a label like Drag City in Chicago, or I'd look at Merge Records, which, you know, now has, you know, I mean, started by the Superchunk people, like, you know, they have Arcade Fire on their label. They're still a viable label, still a very successful label. But you had Sub Pop, which was in its heyday then, Kill Rock Stars. Like, there were all these, like, just, you know, Touch and Go, just tons of great independent labels. And I just thought, you know, and I wasn't alone doing this. So it wasn't just me and like a, you know, in a bedroom, just, you know, printing records out and stuffing them in envelopes. But I had partners, I had people involved with me at the time, but there were just so many great viable record labels, and there was just so much music, so many bands. I just felt like it was possible to do that. And it was sort of the you know, there was that resurgence in the idea of putting vinyl out, and people were putting out 7-inch records. And that's how we started the label, just by putting out a simple 7-inch and then, you know, starting to mail it out to college radio stations, and then, you know, sell it on consignment to the local record stores in town. And then that led to finding distributors, you know, throughout the United States.
Do you feel like at the time it was just like, I don't mean easier because that sounds so simplistic, but do you feel like it was just, how do I say this? Like, there were less gatekeepers going on, that you could kind of really tap into a whole very rich scene of artists and burgeoning talent?
I don't know. I look at what's going on today, and, you know, the connectivity between all of us and with artists. And I mean, there's more music coming out today than there ever was back in those days, when there were all these labels, when there were so many more label options. I mean, the construct of the music industry was so much more, it was so much more solid and developed. You know, now it's a much more amorphous and fluid situation. I mean, streaming is obviously obliterated, you know, even the model that had finally become accepted just a few years ago with digital downloads. So streaming, you know, completely obliterated that economic model, and how people consume music is so much different than it was even just 5 to 10 years ago. So I don't see it as easier or harder, you know, back then as compared to now. I just see it as different now as compared to then, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
If anything, we were more isolated then, because you just, you know, you were literally at the peril of your landline and your fax machine to get stuff done.
Right.
It was ridiculous.
Right. But at the same time, so was everybody else. So it was sort of like, you're all in the same boat.
Exactly.
But I'm just wondering though, too, was it like an easier, because right now things with the sort of the democratization of music, so to speak, it's like, you know, you can like throw a pebble and hit like three artists on the street kind of thing. But I'm wondering at the time when you were in LA in the mid 90s, was it a similar thing in that all these amazing artists were in LA just waiting to find a great indie label kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that was certainly the case. I mean, whether they were here and already existed, meaning like they came from here, they were indigenous to LA, or they moved here because they wanted to be in proximity to the business. Certainly there was so much going on. And there were so many artists around. I mean, I think I saw Rage Against the Machine's like fourth show.
Oh, wow.
You know, fourth or fifth show. Uh-huh. I mean, they didn't play too many shows locally before they were signed and making a record for whoever, I can't remember, like Sony or Epic that had signed them initially. So, you know, but like that was the kind of talent that was, you know, just readily available and around Los Angeles at the time.
So, interesting, like you know, becoming an entrepreneur, what was that experience like for you? Was that something that you were just like a fish in water and you were like, oh yeah, I got this, and managing people and managing artists and managing a business? And like, what was that experience like?
I mean, I think I walked through it despite the fear. I mean, I think I was in constant fear of maybe feeling a bit like an imposter. Like, I mean, I was learning on the go, on the fly. So to take a band, like say in the management capacity where you're with a band who's not connected at all, has barely recorded anything on tape, and they've been rehearsing in their garage or writing songs at home. And then to take them from that place all the way to the point where you're sitting around a conference table with like Jimmy Iovine. Like, I mean, it was really exhilarating. It was really thrilling, but it was also super nerve wracking for me because I constantly felt like, I don't know enough. I don't know enough. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I hope they don't discover that, you know, I'm a fraud. And so, you know, which, you know, now that I even say it to myself, sounds a little painful, but, I mean, I have to say it was balanced off by the exhilaration of just being involved on that ground level with music. And again, going back to like what I talked about right at the beginning with you is like being enveloped by music. Like that was my goal. And so I was living my dream in that sense. So it was exciting.
Well, I want to hear about, because you're a music entrepreneur now in a very interesting time. And I want to hear about going in from the 90s to the 2000s and when everything started to change really drastically. And if you can kind of walk us through your experience of that and just sort of the tumultuous things that you experienced kind of firsthand with all that going on.
Yeah, I think what happened was, you know, you could see sort of the writing on the wall, and the writing on the wall was that the advent of the MP3 as a digital file format really transformed, again, like how music was delivered, how it was consumed, and it put the fright into the existing label structure, the record label structure. So they just didn't know what to do with it. And, you know, it was the dawn of the Napster age, where all of a sudden, all the economic models of the music industry that had been in place since, you know, the 30s or the 40s, you know, began to really wobble and start to crumble. And so, you know, I saw that happening. And, you know, it was funny. I was looking for a job. I was interviewing for jobs. I had sort of stopped doing my own thing with the management company and the label. I mean, those were, although the management company made us a little bit of money, the record label was more or less a labor of love. And so they were, you know, it's very difficult to make money from you know, selling records. It's you have to have, you know, something that really moves a tremendous amount of product. And we did for an indie label, but you know, we were all self-financed. So it wasn't like we were doing this from a huge bank loan and giving huge advances. We weren't that kind of label. And so, you know, I had stopped doing the label and the management firm on my own after about four or five years. And I was interviewing around, you know, looking for a marketing position at a label or a product management position, as they called it. And I got turned on to something that seemed to be out of left field, which was interviewing for a position at a music and sound production company. And they were a music and sound production company in the post-production world. So that means they were composing music and doing sound design for films and television and commercials, and occasionally working with recording artists as well. But they were just sort of this very left of center enterprise based in New York and LA. And so I interviewed with them, and I was actually turned on to the company through a very traditional record label contact, and it was David Byrne's record label. He had a he had a subsidiary label at the time through Warner Brothers and called Lawakabop. And my girlfriend at the time was an A&R person for you know Warner and Lawakabop artists, and they knew this music production entity, and they kind of had turned me on to the possibility of a position. And the music production company wanted to start a small indie label. And so, you know, when things were really going kind of you know, a little bit topsy turvy, and the foundations were shaking of the traditional music industry. It sort of became this sort of alternate operation or enterprise that seemed a little bit left of center, you know, seemed like something that could be really interesting, you know, for me to fall into and explore. And so that's what I did. Like, I all of a sudden got thrown into the music and sound design world for post-production. And it was just like a very fortuitous move for me. Like, I mean, who knew that many of the major labels would just start to really crumble as a result of, you know, the digital age. And so moving into the post-production world and learning about post-music score for films and commercials and music supervision, you know, became a free-floating life raft for me and my career.
Wow, that's so fascinating. I mean, talk about like, wow. I mean, that's so forward thinking. I know it was probably just sort of like, oh shit, look at this. This is interesting, but what a great move, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's totally insulated from all the shit that's hitting the fan for the traditional music industry. And now, obviously, that entire music production post sync, all that is like completely exploded. Obviously, it just keeps getting hotter and hotter.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to put a time frame on it, I mean, that first company I worked for, the one out of New York and LA, which, by the way, at the time, like, having a bi-coastal company was like a big deal when you were a small creative company. They were called Tom and Andy. And that was 1997, just to put a 1997, 98, just to put a point on it, basically.
Mm-hmm. Now, did they have an in-house music library that they were using, or what was their?
No, they had a very small in-house music library, but they had a lot of composers working.
Got
for
it.
Them.
They
were composers themselves. They had met each other. Tom Haidu and Andy Milburn had met each other when they were in graduate school at Princeton, and they both were, you know, music and computer geeks, and formed the company thereafter. And, you know, they started the company in New York. They had a great studio in Soho in New York, sort of at Spring and Green Street. And, you know, it was very much modeled after Andy Warhol's factory, just sort of a place for all these different young creative people to come together and, you know, form this interesting enterprise, this interesting company. And they just happened to work, you know, sometimes they'd be working with Lou Reed or Laurie Anderson on a remix of one of their tracks. And then the next day they'd be working on, you know, a Cheerios commercial. And then the following day they'd be doing sound design for like a Beastie Boys video. So it was just like this really very
fantastic.
Like this very eclectic, creative entity without a lot of structure at the time.
Well, how long were you there for?
So I was there for 5 years. I worked for those guys for 5 years, mostly in their Los Angeles office, although I did spend a little time going back and forth between LA and New York. Most of my career with them was in LA. And then I left them after 5 years and then went to work for what was at the time the largest or most successful commercial music production company in the United States by far. They were called Elias Arts. And so I became, in my first position I took with them was West Coast, general manager of the West Coast. And then from there, within a year of being their West Coast GM, they promoted me to become, you know, national GM. So I was managing both their Los Angeles and New York operations.
So was this the case where they're now like actively pursuing artists or songs that they want played in commercials?
Well, they were another composition shop as well. Like, they composed music, they did sound design, they did a bit of music supervision. They had a much more developed and vast music library, but they also were doing deals with artists, enlisting artists to work on different commercial projects or film projects through them. So one of they called the program or the creative service, they called it Artist in Residence. So one of the first deals they did with an outside artist to work through them on a commercial project was Tricky. So Tricky became one of their artists in residence. And then, you know, I brought in an artist that was super hot, super popular at the time, called Fisher Spooner to you know, work as an artist in residence. And then we had a couple of others as well. So they had that creative service going for them too, as well as the composition stuff, as well as the music library stuff, et cetera.
So when you're talking about these projects, they would basically be like, we're going to put out this film, we want you to score it kind of thing?
It could be that, or it could be like, hey, Microsoft has an eight spot commercial campaign. Can you write the campaign theme for, you know, this Microsoft project? So it could have been an independent film, like you just said, or it could have been through an advertising agency and their client in that case, like a Microsoft, coming to us and then wanting us to connect like Microsoft and the agency with, say, Tricky, and Tricky would write the brand score for Microsoft.
Okay. Dude, this is going to be a bizarre question, but do you remember when it wasn't cool for artists to have their music featured in like commercials?
Oh yeah. Like that, when I started,
when was that?
It was like pretty much, it was really until, it didn't become remotely cool to do that until about the early 2000s. So I want to say like, it really didn't start to catch on as a viable money making, you know, thing for artists, like something that could really earn them a lot of money, until like 2003, 2004. That's, you know, when I started at Tom and Andy, the first company I worked for in 1997, like there were no artists in the world who were willing to like license their music for commercial. I mean, it's film use, yes, but not for commercials. Like that was like highly uncool.
Right. And now obviously we've done a complete 180.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like artists will cut off their arm to have like a corporate benefactor.
Right. And it's sort of like, and the music supervisors are now gods.
Right, exactly.
You know, that everybody's trying to get attention from. So how long did you stay with this company? And then what was your next move after that?
So I stayed with Elias Arts for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then I left Elias in 2008. And decided after 10 years of working in music and sound production for Post, for other people, for other companies, you know, I felt like I was ready and willing to try to do this on my own, but not just do it on my own. I wanted to do it in concert with an established brand. So in essence, I kind of wanted the best of both worlds. Like I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but within a company setting. And so I was approached by Massive Music. And at the time, Massive Music had offices or studios in Amsterdam, where they were founded, and then in New York. And so my New York, the person who's my New York partner in Massive Music, he was a colleague I had worked at a previous you know, position. So we had a connection to each other. He introduced me to the Dutch founding partner of Massive Music. And we all came together with the idea of establishing a studio on the West Coast of the United States. And I would take an equity position or become a partner and start up the studio for them under the Massive Music name. And so after a period of, you know, time negotiating that deal, I joined Massive Music, where I've been for now 11 years, which is kind of crazy to think that it's gone. Yeah, that it's been 11 years and it's gone that quickly.
I know. I feel like your 10 years usually, from what you've told me, is like 5 years. You hit a 5-year mark and you're like, I'm out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, tell our listeners about Massive Music, if you can just share sort of the highlights.
Yeah. So Massive Music, you know, is what we would call a music agency, as opposed to just a production company. We position ourselves as a music agency. And, you know, since the Amsterdam founder started the firm and the studio in the Netherlands, and then set up our New York studio in 2005. We obviously came online, as I just told you, in 2008. We've subsequently put studios in London, in Tokyo, in Berlin, and for a while as well, we were in Shanghai. But we kind of switched our focus over to the Japanese market and left Shanghai a little bit in the dust. And we also have plans to expand, you know, elsewhere around the world, you know, in creative media hubs, you know, in different locations around the world. So, you know, we position ourselves, as I was starting to say, as a music agency. And what that means is, you know, we're not just strictly a production company, although we do continue to write and produce music on a daily basis. So we do compose music. We do sound design. We do voiceover recording. We can do Foley, ADR, et cetera. You know, the work that would entail traditional music composition work. But we also do a lot of music supervision, both on a creative level as well as on an administrative level. So, you know, a client could come to us and ask us to, you know, find a song for them, and then, you know, thereafter look for us to handle all the legal aspects of securing that license. So we do a bit of that work. We also do corporate music branding work. We have a whole area of our company where we do sonic branding, where we create brand score, we create mnemonics, you know, we create UI and UX navigation sounds. We have another area of creative services that we would call music activations. So if there are clients that are interested in using music as a driver, as something to connect with customers or consumers or fans around the world, we try to do interesting music centric activations to kind of trigger that connection point between the brand and fans and consumers out there. So
this is really, really interesting. We're running out of time, and I wanted to ask, because this is so interesting, because I wanted to sort of, as you're the last question is ask you. And once again, it sounds like you're on the cutting edge of the next thing. Is what is your sort of take on machine learning, AI? We're all, songwriters are going to be killed by robots, like taken over. And like this whole sort of continuing interaction of tech and music and streaming and everything else. Obviously, this is like a crazy open-ended question, but sort of, You sound like you're really well placed for it, but I just sort of wanted to get your take on where you think things are headed. I think also, obviously, content is going to just keep generating, and is going to need music. But what's kind of your take in terms of the artist's, you know, viability, the artist's opportunity, again, us not being taken over by robots or AI?
I just think, like, you know, like, as long as there's a balance between technology and the human component in music making, it's all going to be fine. It's all going to work out, and things are only going to get better and better and better. I mean, I just believe there needs to, you know, there needs to be that balance as we go forward. I mean, you know, I don't know if I'd want to hear a piece of music that was entirely constructed, you know, from some type of artificial intelligence. Although I say that now, and who knows, in 10 years, you know, something that is composed by you know, an artificial intelligence may be something palatable to listen to, or interesting to listen to, or engaging to listen to. I think ultimately it's like, it's about, at least in this moment in time, you know, embracing technology for the good, you know, keeping that balance in place with that human element and producing the best content. Because, you know, that's ultimately what people want is, you know, the best content, whether that be, you know, just a well-written song or, you know, a fantastic hook, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of where I stand. I'm definitely not afraid of the technological change. I think the exciting thing about being in the music space is we're always on the cutting edge and the front line of the technological change, and it affects us first because we're a slightly lower bandwidth medium than, say, the visual realm. So we're always feeling the effects of technological change, you know, as I've referenced, you know, whether it was the MP3 or, you know, just, you know, in or streaming, certainly. And by the way, I just think, you know, something like streaming, you know, 5 years ago, I couldn't imagine listening to most of my music, 98% of my music through a mechanism like streaming. Now I can't imagine my world without it. So, you know, like, I think that's really exciting that we're always like, you know, being able to take advantage of the most cutting edge technology that's available. So I'm into it.
Yeah. And I would say, just to add on to that, also with your agency being positioned in a global marketplace, I mean, that's so clearly, despite our current administration's fucking bullshit, I mean, we're essentially becoming this global music business. There's no longer going to be these sort of country borders or culture borders, you know. It's like,
absolutely.
So I think, again, it sounds like your agency is really tapped into that with its presence all over the world.
I agree. I absolutely agree.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Scott. It's been so cool having you on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Yeah. Appreciate the time.
Special thanks to Scott once again for joining us on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Kicking us off right for season two. You can reach them at massivemusic.com. Be sure to follow them on social at Massive Music. I am your hostess with the mostest, L Ariel. That's L.A.R.I.E.L. And I am at L.A.R.I.E.L.Music.com. I've actually moved the Music Jobs podcast website to L.A.R.I.E.L.Music.com/podcast. You can still reach me at musicjobspodcast.com, but I recommend that you bookmark our site, lariel.music.com/podcasts. And we are on the socials as well at lariel.music. Okay, my loves, take care, be safe, stay healthy, and remember, keep on hustling, pursue those dreams, and don't you give up.